The next one is Barbara Rainsby. She's a student and community activist, co-founder of the Ella Baker Nelson Mandela Center at the University of Michigan, which aims to bridge the gulf between the academic community and the black community. She's currently working on a black women's oral history project, and I'd like to welcome her from Michigan. Well, I'll try to be brief because I'm anxious to hear what this audience has to say about some of the things that were thrown out, and also fortunate to go behind sisters who have already articulated many of the points which I think need to be brought out in this session. I'm very happy to see this room overflowing. I think this represents a lot of progress in terms of the black liberation struggle, that we can have a session like this and have standing room only, that we can have the lively discussion we did with Bell Hooks last night, and hopefully a lively discussion that will test the limits of this time frame that we have. I want to talk about mainly three things. I want to talk about the ideology of black women's oppression today and how we need to define it more sharply, the obstacles in doing that. Three aspects of that are the male-centered definition of oppression, which I think we see coming from a number of angles at this juncture, from a number of black male intellectuals as well. The definition of family and the attacks on the black family we see in the current dialogue among sociologists and others who defined our families as broken, as Maxine alluded to in her presentation. And finally, the cultural onslaught of a lot of misogynist representations of black women in popular culture. I think we need to come to grips with these various forms of attack upon black women if we're going to define liberation for black men and women in this period. We've seen over the past few years a reemergence of a very male-centered definition of the suffering, oppression, and exploitation of African-American people. In Juwanza Konjufu's book, Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys, he argues for the paramountcy of black male oppression, tacitly implying that black women's oppression is somehow less significant and less paramount. We see in Konjufu's work a resurrection of Moynihan's pathological black family. We see it dressed up in blackface and are expected to swallow it. Numerous pamphlets, articles have highlighted the crisis of the black male. We often allow this to creep into our language when we say we're concerned about our children, but especially our sons. When we say especially our sons, does this mean less significantly our daughters? Public programs, in fact, are being designed geared exclusively for the needs of young black men. As African American women, as mothers, wives, sisters, daughters, and lovers of black men, we are and should be desperately concerned about the suffering and oppression of African American men and pledge ourselves to struggling side by side for a more humane vision for the future of all our people. However, we cannot allow the oppression of all black people to be made so gender specific that it negates and minimizes, however indirectly, our own suffering and subjugation as women. Such a male-centered definition of black oppression is detrimental to the future and progress of all of our people. And the notion that black men are targeted for special oppression, not simply because of race, but also because of gender, turns much of the black feminist dialogue of the past two decades on its head and suggests not that gender is irrelevant, but that in fact it is males who are targeted for gender oppression, and that indirectly women somehow are exempted and in fact have some kind of privilege because they are women. And that is a very, very dangerous concept. It is a resurrection of a concept we heard by a lot of white historians in discussing the history of slavery. Much of the literature on slavery for a while argued that, in fact, slave women were exempted from many of the abuses suffered by male slaves. In fact, we see in much of the more recent literature by black feminist scholars that, in fact, black women suffered the double abuse of not only being reproducers, but being producers as well. Slave masters would often dig holes in the ground to accommodate pregnant women who had to lay face down for floggings, for being uppity in some cases. So we see that throughout the history, black women have suffered side by side with black men and suffered doubly the burden of sexism. We have to be very cautious and very skeptical about any theory that dissects out sexism from the experience of black women in this country. Such a view suggests some very serious misconceptions about the nature and extent of black women's oppression. Two main things that are often put forth in arguing for the special oppression of black men is the prison system as it impacts upon black men, and it does impact very seriously and very negatively upon our brothers. And secondly, the devastating impact of drugs and violence. But black women too are victims of prisons and violence. Literally, black women are thrown into jail in disproportionately high numbers to our white female counterparts. But on another level, black women are trapped in the prison of poverty, underemployment, homelessness, and hunger. More than 50% of black children are under the poverty level. Who are the caretakers of those children but black women? Teenage pregnancy, dead-end jobs with slave wages are other prisons for thousands of black women. And when you enter the welfare system, as perhaps Sister Miriam Kramer will tell us about in a minute, it very much resembles entering a prison environment. You are processed to the hilt. You are given a case number. You are stripped and searched to the bone by social workers poking, probing, and monitoring every crevice of your life. If that is not prison, I don't know what is. And in terms of violence, black women are beaten and killed daily with impunity. The media coverage of the recent Central Park rape case, in contrast to the brutal murder of a young black sister the week before, suggests the lack of value placed on the lives of black women in this society. But beyond the statistics on rape, spouse abuse, and sexual harassment, African-American women confront other aspects of institutional and economic violence on a daily basis as well. Reproductive choice is increasingly a non-reality for black women with the erosion of Medicaid funding for abortion. Vernice told us about this, and we should take this attack upon us very seriously. In essence, Roe versus Wade has already been reversed for black women. This is an act of violence against women who are denied the basic choices over their lives and their reproductive capacities. The denial of basic health care and housing to black women and children is an act of violence. And the concentration of black women in dead-end service industry jobs at slave wages is another act of violence against black women. So while our brothers are disproportionately victims of homicide and the prison system, sisters too are suffering long and torturous deaths in tiny roach-infested cells reserved for black women and children. The second component of this whole discussion about gender and black liberation, and very related to the first, is the current media hype over the so-called demise of the black family. We are fed some very dangerous and limited and narrow statistics about the breakdown of the black family, which essentially documents the rise in black female-headed households as evidence of this breakdown. Because a woman is not connected to a man at a particular moment in time does not necessarily mean her family is dysfunctional or she is broken. What makes the condition of single mothers so desperate is the lack of economic resources with which to care for their family. Or she is broken. What makes the condition of single mothers so desperate is the lack of economic resources with which to care for their family. This definition also denies the reality of our lesbian sisters who are in quite functional family relationships and love relationships without the presence of our brothers. We have to deal with that. This narrow definition of broken families is rooted in a romanticized vision of the white middle-class patriarchal family. And it's interesting to me that many brothers who are proponents of this view and identify themselves as nationalists. Now, if it's not an assimilationist approach to attempt to model yourself after the Cleavers and Donna Reed, I don't know what is. This has never been an accurate reflection of the black family anyway. We have, since slavery, had elaborate kinship networks, extended family structures, and fictive kin to serve as surrogate parents for children when that was necessary. So the traditional patriarchal family structure has never been something that's been a reality in our families and in our communities. This does not mean that men are not important in our communities. They are, whether we are married to them or not. We have fathers, we have sons, we have brothers, we have neighbors. This definition of broken is one that does not fit the traditional heterosexual patriarchal model. It suggests a warped sense of what families ought to be about. A broken family is a family. In any case, the entire media hype about the black family has been both racist, has been sexist, racist, and elitist. We see in Bill Moyers' TV pseudo-documentary a graphic illustration of the dangers of these myths currently being perpetrated. Bill Moyers, by the way, was the person who initially introduced Moynihan's report to Lyndon Baines Johnson and urged him to incorporate it into a very famous speech he gave at Howard University about the crisis of the black family and the matriarchal black family structure. And anyway, as some of you recall, this show characterized black men as shiftless, irresponsible studs, and black women as mindless, incompetent baby factories. The solution that's posed is basically for white social service agencies to abandon black families and for black patriarchy to reign supreme. Now, many black middle-class leaders, sad to say, are echoing many of the racist, elitist, and sexist messages that we saw in that documentary. Join in the call and join in the barrage of insults and criticisms being heaped upon poor black people, both men and women. What makes this message particularly dangerous on another level is that it's a classic example of blaming the victim. We are told that a broken black family is a single-parent household, and a single-parent household are the causes of crime, drug abuse, unemployment, and everything else bad in our community. Racist, capitalist whites are absolved of all sins. This is also a class question because the families that are targeted, the families that are defined as the most broken, are of course poor families. The parameters of this dialogue have been dangerously constructed, and I suggest if we are going to move toward true liberation, we deal with those who profess to be giving answers on this question and who are defining the parameters of this debate, and that we confront them very sharply regardless of race or gender. The final assault upon black women, and there's been some discussion in this conference among some of the young people about this, which I thought was quite good, is the question of the cultural assault upon black women. As if the economic and the social assaults are not enough, simultaneous with the increase of a very male-centered definition of black oppression has risen a blatant and unapologetic rise in sexism and misogyny in popular black culture. Most notably and profanely in the lyrics and videos of groups like 2 Live Crew. Now we could get into 2 Live Crew. Now, last night, two brothers raised the question, can black men in a white racist society be sexist? I think 2 Live Crew help us to answer that question. In essence, black men are not at the centers of power in this society, but we have all heard of the concept of collaboration. That when you go on television or anywhere else and call black women bitches, whores, toys, and punching bags, you are collaborating with a white patriarchal system that has oppressed us all. And our brothers and sisters in South Africa can teach us some lessons about dealing with collaborators. Now, I think any way you cut it, people who put forward these ideas are not only enemies of black women, they're enemies of black people. whether they're black or white, and sometimes they can more effectively be enemies of their people when they are not white. Now, I'm not forgiving the white, I'm just going to digress on Two Live Crew for a minute because I think it has been an important question. Should we attack Two Live Crew's sexism? Is that in fact another form of collaboration with the system which is trying to silence them because they're black men and so forth? Now, I'm not forgiving the white power structure any more power to have control over our lives than it already does. But neither am I going to allow them to define my heroes by default. In other words, anyone they attack, we love. To add insult to injury, Two Live Crew leader Luther Campbell and his white lawyer and the noted scholar tycoon Skip Gates are going around the country. Are going around the country touting the notion that what Two Live Crew is putting forward is a legitimate reflection of African-American cultural mores on the sexual question. Now, that Two Live Crew is being criticized because white folks don't really understand what they're saying and black people don't really mind them saying that. Well, while kids rock to Two Live Crew, I don't see anybody making a serious defense of the lyrics of Two Live Crew within the black community. I don't see us saying that. You hear people say, yeah, I don't agree with them, but there's not a serious defense of Two Live Crew inside the black community. And I think we need to stand up and say, these lyrics do not reflect the morals and culture of the black community, at least not any segment of it that we want to preserve. So I think while we shouldn't call for the government to censor Two Live Crew, the black community should censor Two Live Crew. Just on this question, briefly, there's the other argument around free speech, which is also related to the issue of gender and the issue of political radicalism. There are people who argue we should defend Two Live Crew because all of our rights of freedom of speech are in jeopardy. Well, for black women in this country, the right to free speech has been an elusive promise at best for as long as I can remember and as long as the history that I know about. In addition, there are political prisoners in this country, like Daruba Ben-Wahad, who was recently released, Assata Shakur, who is in exile in Cuba, and other political prisoners who have been forcibly silenced by this government, had their free speech denied. So if we want to go on a crusade about free speech, let's choose our battle. Let's choose our battles and perhaps come to the defense of some people who have something worthwhile to say. Okay. All of these trends discussed, I think, represent a whole wide range of assaults upon African American women, an attempt to marginalize African American women's experiences in the current dialogue about black liberation. And these trends must be reversed. The question is, how do we do this in practice? And I want to take the opportunity, which Vivian had asked me to do at some point in the text, to talk a little bit about some of the local struggles that have been going on in Ann Arbor. I think in our small way, we have attempted to address the question of race, class, and gender, not as an intersection, but as a symbiotic relationship. We often hear this discussion of the intersection of race, class, and gender as if these are three separate units colliding at some metaphoric intersection. But in the lives of black women, these three variables coexist simultaneously. And when we come to grips with that, we see the radical potential in organizing among poor and working class black women. In a pyramid system such as we live in, the people on the very bottom, the people oppressed not only by class and race, but gender as well, have some of the greatest potential for uprooting that pyramid, because if you push it up from the bottom, the whole thing is made unstable. And I think that is part of the radical potential that black women have in this country today. One of the things that we tried to do is also address the class question, which is at the crux of the black liberation struggle today, in my opinion. We've tried to transcend the college campus and to take African American students off the campus and into the local community in Ann Arbor, We've been involved in struggles around housing, where four families were evicted from a public housing project under this new crusade against drugs. Four families of women and children were evicted and put up as necessary prices to pay for this war against drug under the new seizure law. We came to the aid of those families and have been working with an organization in Ann Arbor called Unity, which is led by African-American women in public housing, and attempted to enter into a dialogue that struggle is not only a struggle around economic issues, but it's a struggle about empowerment for those women who are some of the most marginalized sectors of the Ann Arbor community, which is a elitist, white, academic community, and to put those women at the center of the dialogue about political change and political struggle in the black community in Ann Arbor and among the left forces in Ann Arbor. In our work, we've attempted to merge theory and practice in this regard and understand, again, the importance of transcending the class divisions that have been put between us, and understanding that in this period, particularly, the trade-off has been in the post-civil rights era that a handful of middle-class black folks will be given a few crumbs in exchange for silence about or attacks against the majority of our poor and working class brothers and sisters. And this is true among women as well. And it's important for us to, in a very conscious way, reject that and offer an alternative praxis in response. In conclusion, I just want to conclude by saying a little bit about how all this relates to Malcolm. First of all, as the other sisters have said, I think our first job is to frame Malcolm within the context of a larger movement, that we do a disservice to the many other people who fought and died in the movements of the past if we began to deify Malcolm or Martin or Marcus or anybody else. He taught us many lessons. He taught us to be proud. He taught us that if we stood together, we could win. He taught us to not be silent. He taught us that our anger was legitimate. And he taught us, and I hope this is the last conference I come to where a brother stands up and said he gave us our manhood. I think after that long discussion about gender last night, I think in some very special ways he helped to empower us and give us our humanity. For some of us, he was a more androgynous figure in that we weren't striving to achieve our manhood. But I think Malcolm, one of the things that Malcolm represents, which has been a wonderful theme in this conference, has been the importance of carrying on, the importance of learning from our mistakes, the importance of humility when we make mistakes, and to reject the kind of arrogance that stagnates our movements time and time and time again. And in the spirit of Malcolm, I think the next phase of the struggle has to be one that not only incorporates the issues that Malcolm addressed intensely and repeatedly and very well for all of us, but many of the issues that he didn't address as well, such as sexism and homophobia. And I hope we take up that mantle.